The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm here at beautiful Westcott Vineyards with the winemaker, Casey Kulczyk. Casey, thank you so much for finally doing this.
Yeah, of course. We've been trying to set this up for a while.
Let's just start here. I got all these questions. I want to talk about you and your journey. I'm going to throw out a generalization. You tell me if it's true or not. I didn't know much. I didn't hear much about Westcott maybe about 2.5-3 years ago. Now, you guys are all over the place. Like, not only your wines at the LCBO, articles, awards being won. This happens to a vineyard. It feels like it happened, you guys, about a year ago, where you became one of the sort of it Niagara vineyards. True or false, fair or statement, just about, it seems like Westcott has really grown in awareness over the last couple of years.
Thank you for all the kind words. That's fantastic. I think absolutely Westcott has been, you know, kind of rising through prominence. I think one of the things that a lot of people don't recognize is we're still a very young vineyard. So we see our vineyards coming of age. We have been lucky enough to acquire other fantastic top note vineyards. And I think as we find ourselves and we find our name and everything kind of evolves and comes to age, we're getting more notice. And we've definitely upped our production, and we've also kind of upped our efforts, and we're continuously trying to improve.
Like, I came here because I have family that lives literally a 4-minute drive from here. It was about a year or two ago where I just started trying some of your Chards and Pinots. I was just kind of like, holy shit, this is good. And then I remember the last time, I think it was like your entry-level Pinot was going for around like $30. I might be off by a buck or something. And I remember thinking, this is like just crazy value for just the entry-level Pinot. I thought just absolutely knocked it out of the park. And so, you know, I bought a ton of this stuff. And it really feels like the last 3 years, this place has certainly gone onto my radar. And let's start with you. Let's start here. I asked this of a bunch of the winemakers. You went to Niagara College. For people that are younger, people getting into the industry, your thoughts, would you recommend school for people wanting to get into wine?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm an early college graduate. Mm-hmm. And I would say one of the best things the college did for me was a foot in the door. I think, you know, having education and a bit of a knowledge before you come into any industry is paramount and very important. However, it's also an industry where you mentioned, you know, young people are coming in. It's an industry that's actually full of many different characters and many different ages, and people have many different backgrounds. So I think although the college offers a fantastic entry point, the biggest thing in this industry is experience. So get yourself out there, go see wineries, taste wine, see if you can do harvest, travel around, meet the people, and if you really want to engage in it, like I said, get a little bit of experience and speak to different winemakers, different viticulturalists, different enologists, and see if you can get your hands dirty that way. You know, like I said, I think the college and education is a great jumping point, but if you want to get, like I said, right into the industry, I think, you know, your best bet is experience and having hands-on kind of applied education in the cellar.
Well, in my business, it would be the equivalent of if you want to be in radio in Toronto or TV in Toronto, go to a small town and just start talking, get on air, get your reps, and that'll help you get to bigger markets. I read that you discovered wine as a university student. Not a lot of university students discover wine. They discover beer. If you're of my age, Purple Jesus. Now it's White Claws and things like that, which tastes like TV fuzz. But how did you get into wine as a university student?
Yeah, my pursuit of the wine industry is a little colored with practicality, I think. Mm-hmm. So in university, it made perfect sense to me that wine was some of the most approachable, bang for your buck, good time alcohol. So
right.
You could, yeah. And from there, so that was sort of how my approach to wine began. From there, though, I was intrigued by the fact that there was, when you walked into our LCBO, obviously I'm from Ontario.
What university, what small town?
This was, so I grew up in a small town called Palmerston, mm-hmm. and I originally went to the University of Guelph. So quite the little agriculture university. So I went to the University of Guelph, an agricultural school, and my time there was actually spent in pharmacology. So I was doing pharmaceutical sciences. I then changed my path to wine. But like I said, at the time when I was at Guelph, that's when I discovered wine and drove me towards the career I have now. But the thing that I found very intriguing, I think still drives me to this day, was why, when you walk into the LCBO, is there wine? Why is it divided by place? Why is it divided by country? Why is it divided by region? And that kind of grasped me. And then when I found out, well, wait a second, not only is, you know, all this interesting international wines here, there's a place that says Ontario. There's a place that says Canada. There's a place that says Niagara. Wow, Niagara is not that far from here. Niagara is a very interesting place. And from then I was kind of engaged. And then on a separate note, which kind of drives me to, you know, what makes Westcott so interesting in the pursuits of my own career, I found a place called Burgundy.
Oh.
And not to wax on poetically, I just found it really interesting after discovering all these regions and countries being outlined, that Burgundy not only was a region in a country, but it didn't even tell you what the variety was. It really only cared about where it was from, which was what interested me in the first place. And that kind of led me down the path of my experiences and still is the background to what we, you know, how I make wine here at Westcott. And in a parallel vision with the Westcotts, you know, they grow predominantly Pinot and Chardonnay, mm-hmm. as an effort to express the place that we are, because that's what makes us different. So it kind of comes full circle from my initial impressions.
So initially you're a teenager at Guelph and you can just find like a $12, $10 South American red wine with 15%+ alcohol. And yeah, okay. So then my question is, yeah, by the way, we were all there. That's why I always say Yellowtail is important, because it then starts a lot of people's journeys. Was there a moment, was there a wine where you're like, wait a minute, this isn't just getting drunk time. Okay, I'm fascinated. What the hell's going on the nose? What the hell's going on the palate? Why does this taste like this? Ooh, I'm curious.
Oh, one particular kind of bottle you're saying. So, interestingly, or not interestingly, maybe not interestingly, it was a Louis Jadot mm-hmm. Bourgogne yep. Shard. That was it. A base level Burgundy. To this day, you can still get the LCBO. That was the one where I'm like, oh, this is something different. And that was kind of what I said engaged me into wine and engaged me into Burgundy. And from there, yeah, I kind of pursued a different path in my life.
Yeah, but the thing is, that totally makes sense. So you're in Guelph, you're studying science, you're in an area that's known for agriculture, you then try Burgundy, and now you're making great Burgundian wine here in Niagara. Like, your journey makes a lot of sense. Like, if you put those data points, it does. It makes sense why you're here now.
Yeah, no. And I'm going to put a little argument against what you just said.
Do it.
So we're not making Burgundian wine. We're making Niagara wine. We're yes. making bench wine. We're making wines from Vine Mount Ridge, where we're sitting right now. We're making wines from 20 Mile Bench. And I don't want to get on my soapbox, but
get
like, this is very much what makes us who we are. And that's the pursuit we have here. And this is why our vineyard matters. And this is what makes us different. And despite, you know, obviously the Burgundians having many generations of this and understanding that these varieties are so transparent in the way they can represent where they're from, you know, we are still representing where we're from. And, you know, I do get a little bit cross when people call us Burgundian or compare us to, oh, your wine is like Chablis, your wine is like a Poulny, your wine is like a Gevrey Chambertin. It's a compliment that I appreciate, but I want our wines to be, well, your wine is like where you are. You know, there is a vein of interesting character that comes from your vineyard on Vine Mount. There's a very interesting kind of lineage of the wines you're making from Butler's Grant. That's That's the story I really want people to tell. So sorry, I'll get back off my soapbox.
No. Actually, let's stay here. What has to happen? Because you see this all over the world, a place that specializes in Burgundy and Chardonnay, or in Pinot and Chardonnay. And I've seen this in Ontario. I've seen this in Napa. I've seen this in North Island, New Zealand, where when someone is talking to you, the first thing they say is, well, we make ours in more of a Burgundian style. What has to happen for that line of marketing to be vastly reduced here in Niagara?
It's a fair comment. Again, I'll kind of pick apart what you said. What is Burgundian style?
It's an easy, lazy way of just saying Pinot Noir and Chardonnay that isn't big and fat and fruity. I think is just, it's sort of a lazy shorthand to describe, you know, what a winery is doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the big comparators that ends up coming up a lot is the fact that we're cool climate, right?
Yeah.
And to put it in basic essence, that means we have the ability to lengthen ripening. So theoretically, we're having that extra time to develop flavor, but we can also maintain acidity. And that's the thing I love the most about Pinot and Chard. Obviously, red and white, very different grapes. Acidity makes wine go round for me. That's why I love sparkling. And, you know, I can't ever imagine making wine anywhere but in a cool climate where we can manage that. To back to your question, to reduce that marketing commentary, I think what we do here is, I'm a big Formula One fan, and famously, many people have always said, you want to win the race in the slowest way possible. I think this is applicable to how the philosophy of winemaking, the philosophy of wine growing at Westcott works, in the way that we want to make the wine with the least impact possible. So we want to have as few interventions as we can to make the best wine. Obviously, we're not going to leave something that, you know, needs a little bit of help or needs a little bit of guidance. But I think the concept is, let's get to where we need to go as slowly and hands-off as possible. And that will be the most reflective of the place we are and the wines we grow.
And when I drink your wines, they do taste different than Pinot or Chard if it's Niagara on the Lake. And you can absolutely tell the difference. By the way, F1. I think Kelly Mason is a big F1 fan as well.
That's, she's got great taste.
Yeah. It's funny. When you mentioned, I'm like, okay, that's the second person, you know, that's big into F1. I mean, maybe if we had time, we could discuss Drive to Survive and how much is that doing to get more mainstream people or more people to start to pick up on F1. If we have time, but I know you are a busy fella. I want to bounce back and forth between you, your journey, but I want to stay on this theme. Correct me if I'm wrong, your grapes and Butler's Grant 20 Mile Bench Appellation is your grapes and where we are. And I should have this all memorized. Is this all 20 Mile Bench?
So you mentioned Butler's Grant. Mm-hmm. So that is a vineyard that we were lucky enough to acquire in 2019.
Right.
It is indeed 20 Mile Bench, and it is bench through and through. I think sometimes we talk about the bench lands, which is kind of everything this side of the canal, but the bench is really a very narrow and kind of short portion of the escarpment that is a bench. What is a bench? It is somewhere you sit on. It's halfway between standing and the ground. Mm-hmm. And that is what the bench is. We have 20 Mile Bench, we have Beamsville Bench, and we are lucky enough to have a vineyard on there. Where we are sitting right now is in Vinemount Ridge. We are not on the bench, and we are actually on top of the escarpment. And one of the things that's very unique about this vineyard is one of the kind of defining factors of growing grapes or growing any tender fruit, what allows us to have this kind of, you know, Canada's banana belt moniker around us is lake effect. Mm-hmm. And where we are sitting right now, we do not experience lake effect. The concept of the moving of the heat and the swirling of the winds and that kind of buffering effect of Lake Ontario, which is massive, we don't experience it. We're 2-3 kilometers too far away from that. So we have a very different growing situation here, and it's much more extreme. We tend to be a lot warmer in the spring, summer. We tend to be one of the first places that starts budding. But past that, in the winter, when we have extremes, we tend to be colder. We tend to get lower temperatures.
So what does that mean for the profile of the wine? Because this is, One of the things I've been doing a lot more in the last year or so is just trying to drill down so people understand if the quality of wines in Niagara, if you buy it from here versus 7 kilometers away, it's going to taste very different. And I always want to break just, and I get why people that are just getting into wine, they don't understand it. They just assume there's sort of a monoculture with Niagara wine. Oh, it's Niagara wine. It's going to taste like this. I'm, no. It's going to taste like this if it's from here. If it's from there, it's going to taste like that. So just with those more extremes, how does that translate with your whites and reds?
Yeah. So the first thing we could talk about, and an easy thing, and we've been kind of chatting about place and Burgundy stuff. The thing that makes you different is where you are. So the climate is a big part of that, but the other portion is soil. The soils up here are going to be different. The soils on the bench are going to be different. The soils on the north side of King Street are going to be different. And I think that plays a big factor in the way the vines develop, the way they age, the way they adapt to their environment. And the longer, I mentioned this earlier, the longer we can have a vineyard, the more we can learn about it, but also the more it learns about itself. Because those vines become of the place they are and less of the variety or clone because they're adapting to the conditions. So to me, I think this is something that we are getting to the point of. So up here in Viamount Ridge, yes, the conditions are more aggressive. In the winter, when we have a bad winter, it's much worse up here. Mm-hmm. We take mitigating kind of opportunities or kind of mitigating plans to deal with this that may be different from other vineyards, but we love the difference that it brings. So what we're talking about is we start our season earlier. Not by much, but enough to make a difference. We ripen till we get to flavor. We have different vigor here. We have different crop loads here. And the vines have kind of adapted themselves to that. And through this, because we can sometimes, we're some of the first to pick. This is one of the weird things. We have just a kind of side anecdote. We always have this conversation, and I have a with Grant every year. And he always goes, well, why do you want to pick? No one else is picking. No one else is doing anything. It's like, well, they're ready. They have flavor. They have acid. They have balance. I think it's time to go. And he always goes, well, no one else is doing anything. Are you sure? And it's like, yes. And we have this conversation every year.
would that be the main thing you guys bicker about?
You know what? It's a family-run winery. Although I am not by name part of the family, I've definitely been adopted in. And yeah, we definitely bicker like families on a lot of times.
Yeah.
But we also resolve everything in the same way. But yes, at harvest, it's always a fun first pick because it's that can't be right. No. No one else has done anything yet, you know? Places, and it's honest and it's true, but we start first, and it's because of that. We already have that flavor. We already have that balance. And because we're picking early, we're maintaining so much acidity and liveliness and vibrancy to our wines. And that's again, like I said earlier, that's what drives me, right? Mm-hmm.
And if you wait too long, then it gets too warm, then it gets a little more flabby, then you can lose some of that acidity. Did you ever get insecure about that? Maybe your first year about, wait a minute, we're picking now. Uh-oh, no one else is. Oh, I know some of those other people. They're smart people as well. Why are they waiting? Why am I picking? Like, were you ever a moment of insecurity?
Yeah, I think winemaking is always a moment of insecurity. But that's the thing, right? And it goes back to the comment about getting that experience. You have to believe in, you know, your opinions and your thoughts and that your experiences have culminated that you're making the right decisions in mm-hmm. the place. But not to say, you know, you mentioned Kelly, but, you know, we have a lot of colleagues in this area, you know, and we're a close network as winemakers. A lot of us have worked together in the past. We're experiencing the same seasons, although we're all doing different things and have our own paths. It's we definitely communicate with these kind of things and see where we're going.
So you finished school. What's the path from you at school to you at Westcott? How did you two meet? It's almost like a relationship, like dating. Like, you know, tell me your relationship story.
Yeah. So not to dwell too much on all my experiences, but I did get to travel a little bit. I spent some time in New Zealand. I spent time in California. I spent time at a few different wineries, both this and that side of the canal. So Niagara-on-the-Lake and bench side. Again, every one of those experiences was kind of driven by trying to figure out, okay, how does a warm climate make Pinot? How does a continental climate make Pinot and Chard? How does, you know, and get the different influences and the different ideas, and then see how people do it around here. Because like I said, I'm Canadian, I'm from Ontario, I'm from a small town farming community. My ultimate path was always here. What shape that took, I didn't know at the time. And obviously, I've been lucky enough to land here at Westcott, but I always wanted to try and figure out how my experiences could drive this industry to the next step. And I think it's very exciting. And on a little bit of a tangent, we're getting to see a lot more Canadian winemakers too. We're starting to grow our own talent that has traveled, but also has the ambition to come back here and make Niagara and Ontario something different. You know, obviously we're a young industry and a lot of the knowledge came from expats of other countries, right? People coming from places like France and Italy, New Zealand, Australia. And it feels like we're starting to see the gradient turn a little bit to homegrown talent. And that's very exciting. I like to think I'm on the forefront of that wave, and that's very exciting. But yes, my path here was driven by trying to see kind of the varieties and the styles that I was engaged with and try and get experience through that. And then kind of my last step before landing at Westcott was at a much bigger, more corporate, in fact, very corporate winery, where I learned an incredible amount of skills in efficiency and adaptability. And it came up through a colleague that I literally had a tasting here at Westcott. Because I hadn't been here yet, and they knew that I enjoyed Pinots and Chards, and they're like, hey, you should really go see this young winery. They're doing some really interesting things, and they're in a really interesting place. I know the owners. I'll set you up. We had a beautiful tasting. We were very thorough, I should say, in our tasting, which was you know, beautiful. And at the time, was, I thought, just such a compassionate and kind way of greeting someone else in the industry. But you know, I've definitely found that if nothing else, the Westcotts are very inviting and very giving. So I felt special at the time, but it's very much the way they are. Yeah, I think we just had very similar philosophies and very similar kind of outlooks on what we could do. And that serendipitous kind of tasting just landed where it was. And they said, you know, maybe, you know, should we do this together? Should we go on this adventure as a team? And I thought, yeah, I think this is a great direction.
What year was that? Like, how many harvests have you done now with Westcott?
So that was in early 2018. Mm-hmm. So we've been at this for 5-6 years. It's kind of insane. Yeah. Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah. What was your first harvest? You mentioned, you know, you were in Napa, New Zealand. You've traveled a bunch. Where and when was your first harvest?
Interestingly, talking about cyclical homecomings, my first harvest was at Flat Rock Cellars, just a few kilometers up the road.
Yep.
Very interesting winery, because although 20 mile bench, we're talking about Appalachians, it sits literally on top of the escarpment and on the bench. So very fun place. But again, when I was in, you know, with my friends and at school, I found their Pinot to be very value driven, a lot of quality, very interesting. And I wanted to go see how they were doing things. So my first harvest was but a few kilometers from here.
And what, New Zealand, what was your New Zealand experience like?
So it was quite interesting. So I was at another family estate there called St. Clair. It was definitely, as most things tend to be in New Zealand, and it was in the Marlborough area, Sauvignon Blanc base. But they had quite a big Pinot holding in central Otago. And also, you had mentioned the North Island in New Zealand, kind of the Martinborough area. I went there because they were making such interesting, cool climate Pinots. They're New Zealand's very much its own thing. I'm not going to describe New Zealand wine to the world, but it was really kind of an eye-opening experience, because they really do act in a different way, and they behave, and they have a different mindset. So that was really an exciting experience. And New Zealand's a funny place. Where we were was a much bigger winery, but again, still family run. I was on what they called the red side, so which I consciously wanted to be part of, because that's where the Pinots were being made.
Right.
That's where the wines I was more interested in. Not that I don't love a good New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, but that wasn't what I was there for. So it was exciting.
By the way, poor New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. If we were going to list the wines that people in wine like to shit talk, I would say New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. I would say Napa Cabernet would be the two at the top of the list that we all shit talk as we wax poetic about Beaujolais and Zweigelt.
God, yeah. No, fair enough. I'll wax poetically about Burgundy. But yeah, and then literally I was lucky enough to end up in California at a place called Reese Vineyards. Very small Santa Cruz producer. Very interesting intent. Very unique winemaking processes and very well regarded. Again, a very young winery at the time. And that, I would say, was kind of the culmination of my influence for Pinot and Chard. Because although the cooler part of what we could consider a pretty warm climate in the mountains, using elevation as one of their tools to manage their climate, it was a very formative and interesting time. And then when I returned here, I was at Jackson Triggs for many years. One of the things that I thought was very unique about that, we already talked about with the efficiencies, and you know, obviously being one of the original companies to really try and define having Ontario and having Niagara, was the kind of the growing sparkling program, traditional method sparkling program. So to be on the ground floor where that was growing to the capacity that it is at now and possibly is still growing, and having the opportunity to execute production against that, to be able to see the research and development that went into building a traditional method sparkling, into building the program, into building the equipment, that was such an exciting time for me. And all of those things I can look back on and use with experience, as again mentioned before, to drive the decisions we make here and have the confidence and knowledge to make the wines we do.
I guess, you know, one interesting thing is you work for, you know, this is a smaller family-run vineyard, but working at the big giant ones, as you mentioned, efficiencies, that kind of stuff must be important because, you know, it allows you to translate some of the skills you learn at the big place and then, you know, find a way to integrate it at the smaller one.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's, again, it's just... You know, it's kind of like collecting Pokemon cards. Every card is a different skill. Every card is a different experience. Every card is a different problem or challenge or mistake. So when these things come up, you have that collection to look back on and say, okay, yeah, I remember seeing that one before. I remember playing with that before.
Right.
That's I think, the biggest thing, right? So whether it's coming from a big place or a small place, it, to me, in my mind, it doesn't really matter. It's the fact that you might not be able, like you said, to get that experience at the small place that you had at a bigger place because size of just capacity or equipment or just the things that become different as you scale. But you still can draw things when something happens or when you have a question or when you have a decision to make.
I have to say, this is the first interview I have done. I've been doing them since 2018, where there was a Pokemon reference. This is the first Pokemon reference used on the podcast. So thank you. Thank you so much, Casey, for the Pokemon there.
Of course. I think it maybe it shows my age of growing up.
Yes. And also shows my age on my Pokemon. Oh, yeah. That's not the Garbage Pail Kids. Get your head out of the 80s. You know, we mentioned before, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about Butler's Grant Vineyard. You know, just a little bit more the characteristics of it and how important is it for what you guys are doing today?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned before, so I guess, or I've mentioned, but I haven't really defined. So Westcott Vineyards owns two estate properties. So there's a property we're doing this interview at, which is on Viamount Ridge. We call this the home farm. Mm-hmm. This was a vineyard that was established in 2008 by the Westcotts, completely planted out, planned, and sorted. And then the winery was built here. Butler's Grant is our second vineyard. It was acquired, as I mentioned, in 2018, 19 being our first vintage, and it is about as the crow flies 5 minutes from here. It is on the 20-mile bench Appalachian, on that bench we talked about, right in between the old lake bed and the top of the escarpment. And it's an interesting one because we did not plant that. We bought it already planted. And it also was very attractive because it grew the core varieties that we really care about. It was predominantly Pinot and Chardonnay. We have a little bit of fringe Riesling and Cabernet Franc. They're very small blocks. But one of the more attractive things was, one, location, and two, the age of the vines. Mm-hmm. So most of Butler's Grant is pushing 30 to 40 years, depending on the block.
That's very old for this, for Ontario.
Exactly. And I think, you know, thinking of an industry that may only be 50 years old, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And past that, we've talked so much about climate. You know, someone listening to this podcast might go, well, that's fine. Like, I drink Cali, Cali cabs that are from 120-year-old vines. Well, there's two comments to that. One, their industry is older than ours. So yes, we didn't have vines like this 120 years ago. Two, their climate's a lot more forgiving than ours. You know, so to have something that's lasted that long in the Canadian climate, despite, you know, me earlier saying this is the banana belt, we still get cold here.
Yeah. That's unique. That's like 30 plus years. That's very unique.
Yeah. So, and we're excited to work with that fruit. The other interesting part about Butler's Grant is it has been associated with so many wineries that have come and gone and still exist today. And just because of the longevity and the age of the vineyard. So it's a really interesting vineyard because it's very rarely you don't talk to someone and say, oh, I did this, or you bring a Butler's Grant to a tasting like, oh, I've worked with that fruit. I've seen that vineyard. Oh, I remember when so-and-so made this wine, or this person or that winery controlled it. And it's the thing that we find very pleasing at this point, or the thing that I think we're excited to write the next chapter in that vineyard is, we own it. It is a Westcott vineyard. Mm-hmm. It was always a farmed, commercial grown vineyard. It was something that was always being sold to another winery. And that's why so many people had experience with it. But did anyone ever get the full picture? And that's what we're working on now. And, you know, it's only realistically been, say, 5 years with it, but we've learned so much.
The old vines, what does that mean for the quality or just the taste profile, like versus, say, a 15-year-old vine versus something over 30? Is there some sort of discernible characteristic difference?
The answer is yes. Every little factor will change. You know, there's
and by the way, the reason I'm asking is if someone who's new into wine going, oh, it's older vines, well, who cares? What does that mean? So what does it mean?
No, that's a great way of putting it. So an easy way to put it is, so let's say you're a commercial apple farmer. As their trees age and they begin to produce less, maybe they're more exposed to different climates. They've had different lows and highs. They've had different disease pressures. They've been wounded. They've been damaged. You pull them out because they're not productive anymore. Mm-hmm. The long story is the yield is not there anymore. And that's the same with vines. That concept is the yield is starting to go down. However, you know, you think about this in the terms of maybe like a person. As you age, you are gaining wisdom, you're gaining knowledge, you're focusing on the world and life itself in a different way. And older vines do the same thing. They're producing less fruit. There's more concentration going into that fruit. That fruit is being loved and cared for. The roots are, you know, expanding and moving in a way that it's exposing a different light to the grapes. So when you talk about old vines, there's a lot of character and wisdom and life knowledge that comes from that. They've gone beyond the topsoil. They've gone beyond a little bit of depth. You know, they may be exposing themselves to bedrock. You know, they've seen some winters. They've adapted to the climate. They've done their, you know, they've done their time, and they're telling their story through the fruit. So yeah, every condition will create a different wine, whether it's young or old, but that's, you know, that's sort of a unique aspect to old vines that you won't get through newly established vineyards.
Do you have a favorite and a most difficult vintage? And by the way, and I'll say, yes, I know, there's no easy vintages. Every vintage is hard and unpredictable, and it can make your life stressful, and you curse the gods, and you wish you could have more control and all that. But is there one year that stands out as, you know what, was a pretty user-friendly year. And was there another vintage where you just want to give two middle fingers to it?
Yeah. So, yeah. The challenging vintage is very simple. It's 2021. Mm-hmm. That was one of the most difficult vintages. However, the comment on a difficult vintage is they can be hard, but it is your job as a winemaker to make the right decisions and make the right things so that the consumer doesn't know it's difficult.
Right. What made it difficult?
It was an abnormally wet year. And as we all know, water can breed all kinds of life and cause all kinds of troubles. So, you know, that made it difficult, but we made really good decisions. We made a lot of concessions as far as yields and such. And I think, you know, the 21 shards are already almost sold out and have found lots of critical acclaim. And, you know, obviously our customers have been enjoying them, which is the most important thing. And the Pinots are, you know, yet to be released. They're just finishing their kind of bottle aging period, but very happy with the quality we were able to produce. As far as favorite vintage, 19 has to be the one in the books that I've enjoyed the most. I found it gave the most kind of classic Pinot and Chard character. Acids were fresh, wines were bright. They're evolving slowly, but in very interesting ways. Honestly, we were able to do exactly what we described earlier as far as cool climate. We were able to hang the fruit, really let the flavor develop, really let everything come into balance. It's just so rare in the winemaking world where you have any form of control. You're often pushed by other circumstances, climactic typically, and weather related, that you get to make all your own decisions. You know, a kind of close runner-up is 23. The vintage has just passed. It was a beautiful long vintage. The wines are looking stunning. I do not predict early victory, so I'm not saying anything, but as far as the vintage went, it was a beautiful kind of balance. We had that same sort of control.
No winemaker ever predicts early victory. Like, yeah, like the level of superstition must be very high among your profession.
Yeah, I don't know. I think everyone works differently. I think
I've never met one. I've never met a winemaker that said, you know what? I can tell already. It's early. This year's going to kick ass. There's always a qualifier. There's always. However, but there's always a qualifier.
That's true. No, that's absolutely
Thank
true.
Thank you. Yeah.
No, you're right. No, yeah, I'll take you on that one.
Yeah. So the I know a couple more questions because I know you got a busy day. You mentioned the 21s still haven't been released yet. That's one of the philosophies you guys do here is you hold back the wines a little bit, which I appreciate. You know, why should Rioja be the place that does that all the time?
Yeah, no, I think it's not necessarily a case of holding back wines. It's just we try and release them when they're going to be at the start of showcasing what they're supposed to. I think that's the easiest way. So shards, they come out a little bit sooner. They find their feet a little bit quicker. And that's kind of the pattern we found. The Pinots, they behave differently. They've got other ways of growing up. You know, they're a different child than the Chardonnay. So yes, they tend to spend time in barrel. They tend to spend extra time in bottle, and they do take a lot longer to find their feet. As I said, we try our best to be as hands-off as possible. We don't use a lot of technology. We don't use a lot of new innovations. We use what we need to make the best wine. But I think sometimes, you know, if, you know, you're introducing a homeschooled child to the world for the first time,
yep,
you know, some of the things that we finish the process with as far as bottling and stuff, it can be quite invasive and it can be quite difficult. So the wines, you know, they shelter in. They're a little concerned about life for a while because they haven't really witnessed this kind of behavior and manipulation. So we just want to make sure they have a chance to refine themselves. And when they do, that's when we release them.
What would you say if you're just explaining to people the profile of your guys' inventory in terms of your whites, your reds, your rosés, the sparkling? If you were going to, you know, just explain to people what to expect when they come to Westcott in terms of what you guys have and the overall stylistic philosophy.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So what, and my answer is probably not going to be all that interesting, but we treat the grapes Pinots and Chards, obviously differently, but as a Chardonnay and as a Pinot, very similarly. Because what we're trying to expose is where they're coming from. So when you come to Westcott, you're going to see many different Chardonnays on the shelf. You're going to see many different Pinots on the shelf. And the defining factor is mostly going to be where they came from and what they're meant to represent. From a winemaking philosophy and from the way we make them, again, I think we've kind of waxed on poetically about the way that we're trying to let where we are do the talking.
Yeah.
And that goes down to the winemaking philosophy too. So we use wild yeast. We're trying to cultivate what's naturally coming in on the grapes. 98% of what we do is that. There's a few exceptions. We're using wild mallow, so your secondary fermentation. We let that go on it is, because those are representative of where we are. And if it's not where we are, it's the winery we're in. It's the cultures that have captivated us here. And we let that tell the story. And then we do try and use predominantly once or older oak, because it offers less flavor. We don't make barrels here, right? Now, do barrels offer an incredible environment and so much evolution opportunity? Yes. So we're always going to use barrels, but we love to use older oak because it doesn't dominate the conversation as much, but it does add all those beautiful things that make the wine better. So when you come here, what you're really going to see is how we interpret Pinot and how we interpret Chard and how the vineyard and location interpret both of those varieties as well. And then obviously we love our sparkling and our rosés. And again, everything's done with intent. They're grown for that. And it's, that's a pretty cool place to come. Quite the interesting vista, very different than anything you'll see anywhere else.
Yeah, this is a great place also just to have a meal, because you come in the summer and there's, you know, tables everywhere and there's, you can... it's just a really great place to have a drink and have a bite to eat overlooking the vineyards. And as you said before, your rosés, it's not an afterthought. Like, you guys put the time and attention into it, which sometimes rosés can be a, well, we can't make a blank red, but we'll at least do a rosé.
No, absolutely. There's the number of times I've heard, well, didn't ripen, didn't work. We can make it in a rosé. We'll have a rosé. Yeah. I've worked at places like that, and that's not the case here. I think one of the things that's interesting, and I kind of talked about the vista, and you know, we're looking at the window here at the vineyard. One of the interesting things that we talk about a lot, and you even mentioned it, is, oh, it's a monoculture. Yeah, vineyards are a monoculture, and monocultures, by all definitions, are terrible agricultural plans. You know, you have a pest or a challenge or a problem. It's very easy for itself to spread very quickly. But one of the things I really enjoy about here is, yeah, we have a vineyard and we manage it to the best of our abilities and we have such great practices. But, you know, I have a farm across the street that grew corn last year. Mm-hmm. It'll grow soy or winter wheat or who knows what next. On the other side, you know, on the far west side, I have a bush. On the south side, I have a different type of bush. And these trees attract different bugs. They attract different birds. They attract different wildlife. You know, we have hares and foxes and coyotes. We have all... This vineyard is very alive. And although it is a monoculture, and it has to almost be that way, I feel like we're a little bit more engaged in the environment. And I think that helps us be a little bit more conscious of our practices in the vineyard. And also, the environment's going to give back to you what you put into it. So when we're surrounded by something like that, I think it offers a lot more to it. Also, it's nice. It looks good out here.
Yeah, it does. it's simple as that. You always enjoy a glass of wine more knowing you're looking at the vines where that wine came from. It's a sense of ownership. It's a head game, but it's a damn good head game, and it makes everything just taste just a little bit. Everything just tastes a little bit better. All right, controversial last question for you.
Oh no.
If I threw the word Jadot and Bourgogne on your bottle, could you charge $15 more, knowing people would pay for it? Because wine buying can be a very conservative thing. You don't have to answer that question if you don't want to, but I am of the belief that if I threw Bourgogne on the Pinots of Westcott, of Clos and Chase, of Batchelder, of Kelly Mason, of Kaylouse, you could charge $15 more and no one would blink an eye.
I don't know. My comment is, you know, there's wines, whether it's Burgundy or anywhere else in the world, that are being sold for thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. So yep. What I'm going to say is wine is worth whatever someone's willing to pay for it.
Very politically correct answer. Which sparkling wine from Westcott should I pair with buttered popcorn?
Well, we got to, I think we got to jump very quickly to our brilliant series. That's our traditional method series. We have a beautiful Blanc de Noir out right now, which again is very emblematic of our kind of respect of the place and having wild ferments and stuff. It's it'll go very well with buttered popcorn.
I would also recommend the Block 76 Chardonnay. As Rick Van Sickle said, it hits all the right notes in a relatively short period of time. Casey, I really appreciate this. I am a fan. I will be purchasing some more of your guys' stuff. I love it. I think this is a place that everyone should come to. Yeah, appreciate, and just in such a short period of time, the imprint you've had here. And I look forward to drinking your vintages, hopefully for as long as you're here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Good. Casey, again, appreciate. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.